we get so hung up on the vote we cast, what, every 4 years. But I would argue that what we buy and what we don't buy is a much more powerful vote. In one of the books I wrote, we did a study on how long it would take to kill an industry if everyone stopped buying it. And we did it on chewing gum, and it was like 6 weeks.
Wow.
If the world stopped buying that object within 6 weeks, retailers would delist it, factories, you know, it would be done. Isn't that nuts that one industry will legally possess everything? Mm-hmm. And 99% of what you buy within the year of purchase will be the garbage industry's problem.
1 year of purchase, Mel.
Wow. Yeah.
All those clothes you're spending all that money on, think about that.
Yeah. I don't even buy clothes like that.
So that's 99% of all items sold are garbage within a year.
Within a year, yeah. Wow.
And it's a good stat.
That's our headline.
Isn't that nuts?
Boom.
All right. Welcome. Business Untitled, episode 28 at this point in time, man. Here with my co-stars, Mike Novogratz, Mel Carter. And today...
Stars. We went from co-host to co-stars all in 28 episodes.
Well, you called us what did he call us?
Conspirators. I don't know. But listen, today we have Tom Zaki, super stud. TerraCycle is his company. It is making a move to, I would say, reshape the global waste crisis. It's some exciting stuff, very timely and important for the future of this earth. So without further ado, Tom, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Give me a hand. You know, when I was a kid, actually, I was fascinated with this. And I've always had this thesis. I'm like, we should have, like, in the cities, you put the thing in the drawer, and it just goes, I mean, in the chute, it goes right down, and it's on a waste belt. And, you know, how we do garbage has just always fascinated me.
Yeah.
And how we, you know, deal with pollution and recycle. And you somehow had similar inspiration, but actually turned it into a gigantic business.
Yeah, it's been 20 years in the making, but it's like waste is a huge fascination for me. You know, it's what got sort of the bug at the beginning is it's filled with all these like crazy anomalies. So, like, you know, in economics, when you study supply and demand, right, it's all about how do these curves intersect and, you know, and so on, what happens. Where do you draw the supply and demand of garbage? You know, you have this phenomenal supply, but you have this weird theory of negative demand, and yet no textbook talks about it. And it's this hugely unexplored area because it's filled with all of this crazy anomalies that you can play with.
So you were originally an economics major, is that right, at Princeton?
So in Princeton, like, they wouldn't, you know, the first 2 years, you can pick anything you want. So I was doing, like, photography, Buddhism, yes, an econ class here and there. And then I left in the middle of my third semester, so I never got to the point of majoring.
I see.
But it was these sort of weird things that got me into, you know, what this whole topic is about, because it's the, I think, most unexplored area of business, yet it's incredibly massive.
Yeah. You want to take us back to the formation, just the idea of this. I mean, you want to go back even further than that?
Let's get into 45 minutes. So let's get into this thing.
Yeah, like,
let's get
like,
right
really,
into the shit.
Where was the kernel? What started here, and what's so special about your company? And we'll go from there.
Yeah, for sure. So you know, the beginning for me, I was always into entrepreneurship. You know, started my first company when I was 14. And
what was that company?
It was like, you know, back when the internet was starting. So it wasn't super crazy, but we did websites for some companies. And back when no one had websites, we got to do, you know, websites for some pretty major brands up in Canada, like Roots Clothing and a couple of these sort of things, but got the bug. You know, I had an employee when I was that age.
Wow.
And, you know, invoicing, all this fun stuff. And I remember, you know, the first year at university, there was this really interesting moment in this intro to econ class where the professor gets up and says, "What's the purpose of business?" And the answer she was looking for was maximize profit to shareholders, which felt not super inspired, right? And so I got this sort of thought on, you know, maybe profit could be more an indicator of health than it is the purpose of being. And that left room to how to sort of try to solve a big problem. And that's how the idea of waste sort of entered the landscape. And 20 years later, it's still been a massive fascination.
Mm. And so if you were going to put, like, in a nutshell, right, I know you're remaking the global waste, you know, supply chain. But tell us a little more about that. Like, how, for the, you know, common person that's listening, what's that look like?
Like that cup right there.
Yeah.
You got an answer?
Well, yeah. So let's take that. So the way we look at this is we first say, what happens at the end of life of that object? Because getting whoever made that cup to change the cup is a big lift, right? So that cup, for example, today won't be recycled because it has a coating of some polymer on the inside, either like a wax or a plastic to hold the liquid. So, and the real issue of recyclability, like what makes the bottle that you're drinking from recyclable and that not, is not that one can be or can't, right? It's that you can recycle that plastic bottle at a profit, and it will cost more to recycle that than the results are worth. And if you zoom out to all objects, right? You know, remember, every single object in this room will be garbage one day, like the chair, the carpet. I mean, literally everything.
TV.
Yeah. And isn't that nuts that one industry will legally possess everything?
Mm-hmm.
And 99% of what you buy within the year of purchase will be the garbage industry's property.
1 year of purchase, Mel.
Wow. Yeah.
All
wow.
those clothes you're spending all that money on, think about that.
Yeah. I don't even buy clothes like that.
So that's 99% of all items sold are garbage within a year.
Within a year, yeah.
Wow.
And that's a good stat.
That's our headline.
Isn't that nuts?
Boom. Get that. Get a clear one on that.
I mean, imagine this. That's a big statement that this industry, the waste industry, will own it all. And it's also measured as objectively the least innovative industry per dollar of revenue. Because it is like shitty, nasty, gross, all these things. Not even a metaphor of it. It's not sexy and fun and so on. So you don't get a lot of talent. Like, we have this joke when we work with garbage companies directly. They're the only industry who still doesn't know how to call into a Zoom link. You know, it's like, you know, it's just really stuck in the past.
One of my first jobs I had when I was 15, 16, 17, I was the head gardener at this guy's giant estate in Virginia. George Halpin, he built Tyson's Corner. He was a real tycoon. Yep. And one day, he had a bunch of guys, and they were literally creating a big patch of shit in the yard. And I was like, what the fuck's going on? And, swear jar. And he was looking at human waste and trying to figure out how they recycle it for minerals, gold, silver, other minerals in the thing. And that way he had started a small business as a side hustle.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how the business ever went, but it actually made part of my summer less pleasant because it stunk all the time.
Yeah.
Well, but you hit something really important, right? Like, we look at recycling and all this stuff. That's the first question on that cup is,
yep.
It, you know, the citizens will look at it as it's the right thing to do, right? That it's like a public service, like education and so on. But the reality is, recycling is urban mining. It's in that example that you just said, it's if there's any minerals in there. The plastic is recyclable because it's valuable, and there it isn't. And the big problem in product design and package design is the biggest mega trend in everything is to remove cost. But if you remove cost, you're also removing any value in that object. And so that's why recycling rates are going down. That's, you know, why more and more waste is ending up being burned, landfilled, you know, this sort of thing. And so for TerraCycle, what we do is we focus only on the things that are not economic to recycle, which is like 95% of stuff, right? Whether it's, say, your eyeglasses or the coffee cup or, you know, you name it. And it's somehow convincing someone, you know, it could be like a manufacturer or a retailer, to fund what it really costs to collect and process that stuff, minus the value. And that is sort of the art of the business, per se.
And how come they're incentivized to fund that?
Well, there's two sides, right? One is that, like, let's just say that was a Starbucks cup, just for sake mm-hmm. of conversation. Well, Starbucks has a problem that cup is garbage. Maybe if it was a retailer, you know, it's they were facilitating the sale. Like, in all cases, there's some level of responsibility, but that only goes so far.
It's a PR problem, and it's a... Has there ever been legal liability on some of this stuff?
Could I sue
Starbucks? If Starbucks used horrible, horrible cups that were unrecyclable and polluted this, could someone do a class action suit and say, you know, screw you, Starbucks, you're freaking... You sell coffee every day at exorbitant prices, and you're polluting the planet.
Well, this is the problem. No, right? And I think that's the biggest issue in sustainability overall, sustainability versus business, is most externalities, like making a horrible cup, you do not have liability over. You and I can invent any object today, and it would not matter what its end of life was at all, right? So you have to use these different tactics. They have public pressure and so on. That goes to the PR example. That is certainly a tactic. But if you can frame it more in how does it help their business, that helps grow it even more. So when we do, you know, we did this program at Walmart where we put out car seat recycling, baby car seats. And in 2 days, we collected back about 10 or 15% of what they sold that year. I mean,
wow.
Thousands of truckloads.
Wow!
But the play for them was it's driving more foot traffic to the store, and if you can quantify that, then you can release the millions of dollars that it takes to, you know, to do that work. And this is, I think, the huge challenge of sustainability is that.
So what did you do with all those car seats?
Well, so those are made from like plastics, fibers, you know, alloys. So in that example, we shred them, we separate, you know, the metals into one pile, plastics into another, fibers into another, and then they can be reconstituted and made into new things.
So is it accurate to say you're basically separating these waste streams and then looking for a responsible party, so to speak, that's going to help subsidize the recycling of that particular vertical stream?
Exactly right. So take a random one like cigarette butts. We're about to celebrate our billion recycled, but collected and recycled. And there it could be the tobacco companies. They have a reason to care. It could be big cigarette consumption locations. Cruise ships and casinos are the two most high prolific smoking areas. And so they have an incentive to, you know, to want to have a solution there. It could be cities, you know, mm-hmm. who don't want the litter. Because if you put out cigarette recycling, litter goes down compared to just, you know, normal cigarette deposit points. So it's these sort of stakeholders to figure out, hey, we need a money flow. Because mm-hmm. in the end, it's all about money flow. Mm-hmm.
What are the, like, five products that piss people off? Like, plastic bottles literally was the bane of everyone's existence. Because you see them floating in the ocean. You see them everywhere. Yeah. And you're like, dude, first of all, the whole bottled water industry seems bizarre because water is free. We got good water in New York, but we all spend $2 a bottle just because it's convenient. And then you got this plastic. Everyone was always pissed off about plastic bottles. What are other products like that?
It's interesting you say it because what is the real big issues are not equal to the ones I'm going to give you the answers to. So we went out and crucified a straw. Right. And yes, rightly, you know, it showed up, you know, up a turtle's nose, created a big sensation. And now straws have been banned, you know, in all these places. But let's remember, 30% of our dumpsters are construction waste. And how many people get bent out of shape over construction waste? So the top waste streams that really piss people off are straws, cigarette butts, coffee capsules, diapers. Maybe those would be like the top four that come to mind really quick. And they all have this like this emotional context to it, you know?
Yeah, I forced my wife to use cloth diapers.
Yeah, that's what I mean, right? Like
what's the real ones that we should be
worried
about?
It is, like I said, 30% of dumpsters or all waste is construction debris, right? Yeah. So when you tear down a house and
that's Dave right there.
Right. I mean it's massive, right?
Yeah.
Think of all these big objects, right, that come through our lives. That couch, you know, that's gonna last 5 years or whenever we move out, you know? And then you just have a lot of what you call sort of the wake of waste, which is even if you buy like an apple at a store without a bag or anything, that apple produced a lot of waste to get there, you know, agricultural film, you know, all sorts of crates and packaging to get it to the point where it looks like a unpackaged good.
Yeah.
And so you also have that big wake that no one even notices.
Right. Did you raise money to start this business? And if so, how much?
Yeah,
how
so in our history, I think we've raised like maybe $125 million, give or take, over, 20 years now, right? And at the beginning, it was, you know, the usual, sort of startup, you know, approach, angel investors. Then we did a Series A, Series B. And then as we went global, we did the sort of neat tactic. We're in 20 countries now where the garbage industry is really fragmented. There's no global garbage player. You know, Veolia, for example, is very big, but in Europe only. Mm-hmm. Or waste management's big, but only really in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
And so these garbage companies started buying interests in our foreign subsidiaries. So we did raises like that. And now we're seeing what, you know, if the markets recover, what that could look like at some point for us. But that was sort of.
So you got rich from picking up shit on the streets.
Something like that. Yes, yes, yes.
I love that.
So waste management, right?
Yeah.
Talk about what they do and how you intersect with them.
Yeah, so our business philosophy is simply to only do what traditional garbage companies do not do. So if you take a waste management, right, it's a very asset-heavy, low-margin business, and its job is simplified to get rid of the garbage as fast as you want, or as fast as possible, while respecting the laws of the land. So waste management basically is a big transportation company. They'll move the garbage from your office or your home to a sorting center, if it's recyclable and they can make some money on it, then they'll find buyers for those materials, or they'll send it to their landfills or incinerators. And so what we try to do is we have a division around recycling. So, you know, what we talked about on that cup. Our second division is how do we help you make the object from waste? So that can range from, you know, ocean plastic into Head and Shoulders bottles, or we're now doing a project to clean up the top of Mount Everest to turn into luxury Swiss watches.
Mm-hmm. That's cool.
Then our next division focuses on how to move to reusable systems. So imagine like your Tide laundry detergent or Häagen-Dazs ice cream is not in a single-use package, but something you pay a deposit for. Mm-hmm. Then when you're done, it's you just bring it back. It gets cleaned and refilled, mm-hmm. and now it goes onto the shelf again. And then we also reserve some spot for innovating around garbage that has nothing to do with how to manage it better. So a sort of far-fetched example there is we launched a program with a big diaper company this year where diapers are medical-grade carriers of fecal samples, right? So imagine you buy a kit, you throw your child's diaper into it, uh-huh. we get it, we analyze the microbiome in the poop, and uh-huh. can predict your child's brain development, immune system development. So that's how far sort of these waste innovations tend to go.
So you're like a garbage treasure hunter.
Something like that. Yeah, almost. Like business models, right?
Yeah,
like interesting ways to unlock business models to create value out of this thing that everyone ignores.
Yeah. Just to back up and just give context, because it's really interesting. Like, garbage is such a misunderstood, like, we don't even think about it, right?
Right.
You put it in your wastebasket, you tie it up, you drop it down a chute, and then it's like gone. It's basically what the normal interaction with garbage is, right? And that goes to landfills, right, which are really bad.
Yeah.
Some of it gets incinerated, less bad, I think, right? And then recycling.
Used to get shipped to China.
Yes. Well, shipped, but the end goal of that is, right, it's either getting into a landfill, it's being incinerated, or it's being recycled, right? That's probably...
I'll break it down for you, right?
Yeah, okay.
So an average person in the West will do about 4.5-5 pounds of garbage a day for volume. Today, if you look at the global number, 25% is informally disposed. This is a global, not just U.S., right? That's a fancy word for litter, or it just doesn't get managed at all. It goes into the natural environment. And, like, even here in New York, Manhattan used to barge all its garbage 10 miles out to sea and dump it up until the late 70s. Mm-hmm. Can you imagine? All of it just into the ocean up until, like, 78, 79.
Yeah.
But what happened to all that garbage?
Well, it's just the heavy stuff sunk to the bottom, and the floating stuff breaks down, like the plastics breaks down into smaller and smaller particles, and you have this whole issue of ocean plastic, microplastics, all these sort of massive issues.
Wow.
But it's important to know, because right now, like, most of this informal disposal is in emerging countries, and we're pointing to them as, like, that's the issue. But, like, we used to do it here until 40 years ago.
That is crazy we did that in the 70s. I knew we did our waste out there.
Yeah.
Huge pipe that would dump all the poop in the middle of the ocean.
Yeah.
We don't do that anymore, but I didn't know we did garbage.
Even the household waste.
That is crazy. Well,
I'm speculating that more and more plastics and bad shit started getting into the stream, right? If you're talking about the 50s, it's probably more organic in general.
But 50s was the moment. Like, I would argue that garbage was invented in the 50s, right? Because if you think about before the 50s, what was our clothing made from? Like wools, silk, cotton, stuff like this. Today, there's probably 80% of the clothing we're wearing now. I mean, certainly workout outfit is plastic, polymers, nylon, so on. The chairs we're sitting on, in the 40s were wood. Now they're all advanced materials. The car, everything you point to is now advanced materials, and then you compound that by consumption increased by tenfold at the very same time.
Yeah, free fashion, whatever they think, the cheap fashion, cheap everything.
Yeah.
Well, like, throw away on that point, here's a crazy stat. 100 years ago, we would have bought 2 apparel items per annum and worn them for 20 years on average. We'd mend them, so on and so. And they were a big percent of our
income. How many years ago?
Right? 100 years ago.
Okay.
And it was also a big part of our paycheck, right? Yeah. Like, it wasn't, like to us now, a $1 t-shirt. Today, the average person, this year, I think it was 67 garments a year, 3 uses before disposal.
That's just crazy.
On average.
Sound like Mike.
Yeah.
I wore these pants for like 8 years.
That's
what you got.
These things used to be red, now they look pink.
I think that's one of the benefits of buying like nice quality, right? Yeah. For real, is that you just wear it a lot longer because you've invested in it more.
I think that's like, I was been thinking a lot about sort of sustainability in business overall. And yes, like my domain is waste, right? But if you think about any environmental issue, climate change, palm oil production, species loss. It all comes from us voting for this stuff by purchasing.
Mm-hmm.
And we're making that so easy. And this is the central sort of thesis of all environmental issues. I don't think business can magically correct itself to be, benevolent from an environmental point of view. We need to think about how we support that by this constant purchasing that we do. And what do we purchase?
So Amazon, let's beat up on Jeff Bezos, even though he's not at Amazon anymore. Amazon is now boom. I mean, every day in our hallway at our building, there's just package after package after package.
Yeah.
How has that shifted? Like, are they, Amazon in particular, but all those companies, are they responsible packagers? Is styrofoam everywhere? Those little peanuts, those styrofoam peanuts everyone said were horrible. Yeah. Like, how do we think about?
I think the two sort of big thrusts, and it's what you're pointing to, that make consumption bad, is the idea of cheap and convenient, right? The more we sort of lever those two things, the more we're creating harmful production. And harmful production is from a waste point of view, so the cheaper things become, the less refurbishable they become, right? The cheaper packaging becomes, the less recyclable it becomes. So here's a good example in beverage containers, right? Mm-hmm. In the US, up until the 50s, we were in reusable glass, right? Your Coke, Pepsi bottle, fully reusable, 95% reuse rates.
Right.
But you had to do your thing. You got to, put them in the crate, put them out, that whole thing. Then came the first disposable package, aluminum cans. And those are recycled at the best rates in the U.S. because the aluminum is valuable. Mm-hmm. Then came soda bottles. They're recycled at half the rate of aluminum cans. Then cartons, cheaper again, half the rate of soda bottles, and then even cheaper than that is like a pouch of some kind. And those are recycled at 0% because they cost more to collect and process than the results are worth. And these two tension points, right, really push consumption into these really challenging areas. I mean, and you see it everywhere, right? Yeah. It's not just, you know, two-hour delivery from Amazon. It's like, you know, companies like Shine who can make fashion incredibly cheap and fast, you know, so, and this is pervasive everywhere.
So cheap and convenient is the nexus at which you can assume that you're doing more damage to the environment by producing more waste.
And it's, look, it's the biggest thing that motivates consumers. Like, we have this reuse division where we're convincing big consumer product companies to move back to reusable packaging. Mm-hmm. Like, not to say that you have to fill it yourself. It's just like the Coke bottle for mold, right? And we've got now, you know, almost everyone, like your Nestle's, P&G's doing this. And the biggest thing we learned in consumer behavior is that consumers want to make everything feel disposable. So when we did our reuse platform, it's gotten pretty good in Japan and France. And there, you can go into a store, you know, buy whatever, your Coke, Nutella, in these reusable packages. But we give you this option of a reuse garbage bag, where instead of when you come in, you put every bottle back one at a time and get your money back, you just throw it all in a bag and you chuck the bag, almost like a garbage experience. And people, you know, move there significantly more. And everything has to do with, you know, fulfilling this idea of convenience on everything. Right.
Interesting. Which countries are the best countries that you deal with in terms of like a sense of responsibility?
That's a good question. Human beings, like, so we're in 20 countries now, and they're all the rich ones, right? So like US, Canada, Brazil, Western Europe, you know, Australia, Japan, these sort of places. And it's so neat that you couldn't tell the human data apart, right? So if I showed you French data compared to Canadian data compared to Brazilian, you name it, you wouldn't be able to draw them apart. The real difference is how the corporates act in those countries. And that's really a derivative of how many laws are coming to force responsibility or are being removed. Like in the US, laws are going in the wrong direction, right? It's deregulation, which means that corporates don't really need to do much more.
Right.
In Western Europe, France, UK are great examples where everything is getting regulated, and that's why the reuse movement is taking off. And all
so
these
interesting.
Things.
Yeah.
We used to ask this question, sometimes we ask it, but in the context of waste recyclables, if you were president for a day and can make a law, like, what would be the most important law regulation you'd make along this?
I would make it one simple thing. If you make an object and you put it out into the world, you, the manufacturer, needs to be responsible for what happens at the end. Mm-hmm. That's it. Right? It's just like if we're going to put a pharmaceutical into the world, we have to go through a process. Mm-hmm. And we, if that was the case, the way design would shift would be just incredible so fast. You know, companies would suddenly think about making products that could be broken down easily or having value in them or funding their own ways to return them so they don't create these massive negatives.
So who regulates packaging?
Right,
who regulates packaging, right? Like, in other words, food source is regulated by the FDA.
Yes.
Drugs are who regulates
packaging is regulated by the domain's safety body. Right? So if it's, say, a drug, it's going to be the FDA.
Okay.
But they're only going to regulate it from a safety point of view, right? So, for example, they'll look at, is there, how do
cap,
those,
exactly,
how does, it from you know, can it be taken off by a child, right?
Yes.
That's a key example. Or will there be leaching between the package and the content, right?
Yeah.
Other than that, it's self-regulated, right?
Wow.
If you're going to, almost all products, it's, there's no
That's
regulation.
Amazing. Here's another question. So I've spent a lot of the last 7-8 years in criminal justice reform. And I had this idea in the last election, which I pitched to every Democratic candidate except Biden, who I never met, of picking a criminal justice czar, like cabinet or sub-cabinet level, to help really coordinate, be the convener for change in our frickin' broken system. It seems like there's a great role. You'd be a great candidate for the trash czar.
The packaging czar.
Yeah, that would be nice. You know, the biggest tension this person would have to deal with right away is, in the end, to do these things that I'm describing, you have to create money flow, which means the price of products will go up because that coffee cup will have to have a embedded, you know, cost in there for what happens at the end, just like anything. And that's going to be the immediate tension for this role is how much embedded cost can they politically
deal with? Now let me ask the next question, which is interesting. So we talk about externalities. Like, what is the cost? So when you used to look at the Hudson, there was all kinds of bottles and shit in it. And for the most part, we've done a good job of cleaning up the rivers. You can almost swim in them. We pick up trash pretty well.
Yeah.
Like, are we at a crisis level? Is it just a pain in the rear level? Like, we know we have this monster amount of trash. US has more trash than anyone in the whole world. But are we doing a good enough job that people are like, eh, no reason for a czar? Or are we reaching a level where we're saying, what are we doing to our planet?
Yeah, see, I would argue we may be looking at the wrong part of it, right? Because to your point, there's not really a mega litter issue, you know, in the U.S. And we do a pretty good job of managing the waste, right? So it's not littering our environments. The problem, though, is if we, just to keep picking on the cup because it's the object of the moment, if that cup is sent to a landfill or incinerated, then that cup has to be recreated again, which means another tree has to go down.
Right.
And that's the real way to think about garbage, not about the end point, but about the value disappearing and that object having to be recreated from scratch. And the biggest drain on our planet is farming, mining, these things that then replace those materials. And that is the huge issue.
So it's extending the life cycle of the packaging.
Of the material it's made from.
The material, because everything's going to be garbage, right? So if you can extend the life cycle of the chair, the sneaker, or this.
You name it.
That's really where the
juice
is.
That's why it's so politically hard, because it's a derivative almost. It's not the immediate.
That's right. Exactly.
I was going to say, you know, with regulatory strategy, I mean, there are times when emissions or something like that, where there's a sliding scale over which you could say, you need to make something recaptured or something last longer, right? You could tell fast fashion, your average time of ownership has to be 8 months, not 6 months, right? Or whatever.
Well, it's like the, you know, recently there's been a good positive wave of right to repair. Which is amazing. You know, like how most companies would not let you repair their products, right? Uh-huh. And this is incredible, especially in, you know, a lot of more complicated products like big tractors and so on, which went from something that you can repair as a farmer on your own to today you have to log in with a computer. They don't give you the software, right? Mm-hmm. And so you cannot do repairing on most things, right? These are
That's
good
crazy.
Examples where
there's I never even thought about that, but I guess your Tesla, you're going to be like,
You can't repair your Tesla.
Yeah, no.
Right? You can't.
No.
You couldn't even open it up, even if you were an expert in electric, you know, cars and all of this.
Right.
There's a lock, you know, that you can't get through. And I get the reason, right? It keeps the business, you know, in that organization. But it's these sort of challenges, right, that produce all these problems.
Yeah. We finally got the universal freaking charger.
Right.
I don't know how long that took and how many political cycles, but it drove me freaking crazy. Every time I got a new iPhone, and I got a lot of new iPhones because I lost all my iPhones. Yeah. You know, different charger.
But you spent a lot of money on cords and chargers,
right?
Yeah. So you helped.
It's amazing how just how almost mean-spirited, like capitalism to a level of just inanity. Like, you know, people that work at Apple are probably decent people, but they're like, let's see if we can screw the consumer just a little bit more and make them buy their 15th plug.
Well, I got a great story. Have you? Do you guys know the genesis of planned obsolescence? So, you know the idea of planned obsolescence, right? Okay. So this came out first when the light bulb was invented. And when the light bulb first came onto the scene, guess what its useful time was?
Probably thousands of hours or something.
Still lit today, 100 years later.
Wow.
There's
one
in Florida, like this light bulb that has not gone off, has been on. Like infinite almost, right? And the problem is if you sell light bulbs that don't break, you're not selling that many light bulbs.
Yeah.
And so the whole light bulb companies all got together, created a cartel, and basically said that we need to take the useful life down of the light bulb. And made it like whatever, 5,000 hours, whatever the number is, right? And it stayed there now until LEDs have come out, and that sort of disrupted it and allowed it to shift. But like this is in everything, you know?
Yeah.
I was buying a washer and a dryer just recently for my home, and the salesman even came up and said, you know, it's amazing. You should really get insurance because it's not like the way they were made 20, 30 years ago where they're going to last. This thing, brand new, is going to break in 5 years.
Yeah.
And when it breaks, it's modular. So every fix is going to be almost the price of the unit.
Yeah.
Right? And it's – but you see how profitable that is at the very same time, right?
Yeah. I mean, there would be a place to regulate. I'm just saying, like, require appliance companies that on average their appliance lasts X long, right? That would start to –
Or this is what I mean. If they had to be fully responsible, right, to then take the object back, right? You create it. It has to come back to you, especially if you have so much power in its creation, right?
Yeah.
Where you're not letting people play with it.
Yeah, think about how many washing machines or mattresses or car tires.
Yeah,
I mean, those piles of car tires are bizarre to watch.
Yeah,
they're like mountains of them, and then someone lights them on fire.
Yeah.
And they...
exactly right.
Yeah.
Still can't believe there's a light bulb somewhere for the last 100 years.
I think it's in a Florida firehouse. You'll have to look this up. But it's been burning the whole time. And it's
the
joke
crazy.
About light bulbs. But it's like it truly everything. You know, is the planned obsolescence was a regulatory, it was a piece of legislation, I think in the UK that was introduced as a way to boost the economy. And it basically said that you would have to make things break sooner because then the cost of replacement would go up, and that would boost consumption.
Right. Who are your competitors in this, and who are your allies, and like what are you the industry? Like, what is the industry?
Well, I mean, you know, so we're not that massive. We're about, you know, 100 million give or take in revenue, so we still have a long way to go. But there's no direct sort of comparison to a TerraCycle out there. What we do have is what I would sort of say is like spot competition. You know, doing one of our business units in one country where there is a company doing cosmetic recycling here in the U.S. or doing blister pack recycling in the U.K. That sort of thing, mm-hmm. but nothing that is looked at it as comprehensively. You know, for us, our bottleneck per se, right? Like what holds us back a little bit, and we have to work on all the time, is how do we get people to voluntarily fund this? Because we're coming in and saying, you do have no legal responsibility to do this. You're not going to get physically back anything, right? But do it because it's the right thing to do. And it's that like seduction tactic of how do you get the corporates to eat their vegetables?
So is your alpha or your genius, you know, your value add in this, is it the salesmanship of convincing people to participate, or is it the technology of, hey, we know how to break your shit down better than other people?
You know, both of those are in play, right? Like, we do have a strong R&D department and all this stuff, but I think it's neither. It's how do we show the company that they're going to drive value from it, right? And so, and it's different in every case. Like, we just launched with MasterCard across Europe, credit card recycling. And there it was, how do we work with, you know, their customers, the banks, to create preference on the MasterCard product and, say, the Visa product, and get people to bring in any brand of card and trade in? You know, these sort of things that we figure out. And that's going to be completely different if we're recycling diapers or recycling cigarettes or recycling, mm-hmm. You know, you name it, right? But it's figuring out how to get that value out of the waste, because that then creates and cements the money flow. Because salesmanship is good when you get the deal, but that wears off real fast, right? And PR too, it's good in year one, but by year four,
so it's
five,
really
or something,
thinking through how it becomes beneficial to them.
Yeah, right. In their eyes, right? Like, the biggest thing I learned is if business is there to serve profit to shareholders, you have to empathize with that. And a good example is when we first launched diaper recycling, we were, you know, 3% of landfills are diapers. We thought this was a great R&D breakthrough that we can now recycle a used diaper. And we went to the diaper companies, couldn't get any action on it. And then we reframed it and said, wait a minute, what if we created bins where you can put any brand of diaper in, but, you know, if Pampers is funding, you know, it weighs it for you and gives you coupons into Pampers per kilo of diaper you put in. Now it's a market share driver, you know, and it's these sort of things that allows us to then get the money flow to be achieved.
Do you spend much time on the regulatory side trying to influence regulatory policy? Because it feels like another hack for that would be to take the most environmentally destructive piece, whether it's chargers or, you know, because effectively LEDs replaced light bulbs because of the mercury level in the incandescent bulbs.
And like and the shitty useful life, right?
The shitty useful life, but also there's a big mercury problem.
That's right,
right?
That's
and
right,
so
that's right.
That was a hot button. It was a third rail. We can't have mercury in the system, so they went to LED.
Yep.
Where else could you push on that where it starts to scare people into
this? Doing a lot. Like, I'll be in Ottawa next week for the UNINC meetings, you know, so we're doing quite a lot of that. For us, the big push is trying to get fiscal responsibility to occur. So the U.S. has started now passing laws called EPR, Extended Product Responsibility Laws, where you make a package, you have to pay a tax, and that creates a fund for that state to run better recycling. We're also really trying to push on reuse regulation to say, let's move away. Because the big issue in all of this sort of convenient, speedy consumption is disposability. So if we can move to, you know, to reusability, that I think is a huge breakthrough. So that's a lot of where we're pushing as well. I say there's movement in the right direction. The U.S. is tough because it's just nothing's happening federally. California, it's pretty neat because they're using their scale as a sort of a bully pulpit where if you can pass regulation in California, it will become the national norm. Mm-hmm. And I'd say it's very exciting in Western Europe right now. There's a lot of really good movement.
So the takeaway, if you could snap your fingers, is it would be for people to make stuff that lasts longer, of better quality, so we're going to have less trash.
Yeah, especially if you don't want to hurt total economy, right? I would say make things that are really awesome, timeless design, more expensive, right? So you get the same net consumption, but it's like, I'm like you, like I've been wearing these pants for 15 years, right? Mm-hmm. And instead of let's buy one every 2 weeks, right? But that can affect everything as well. I think that's really the first step in being sort of choiceful in how we contribute to this.
So what would you, what advice or how would you say you could, for a young entrepreneur who is as passionate or likes the space, as much as you do, how would they even go about getting into this for like this small, small guy?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think, well, first, I would really encourage having a look in the waist area, because I got to tell you, like, you know how we've a couple of times mentioned this idea of waste as something we just want to get rid of? Like, yeah. Think of a toilet, right? Its function is to just get rid of our waste as fast as possible. And that permutates this industry really, really deeply. So there's a lot of entrepreneurial opportunity to sort of unlock an area of innovation where no one is looking, right? And I think, look, as in any entrepreneurial thing, it's get started, grind like crazy, and then, you know, be willing to learn and adjust. And I mean, that's how we started, as a basement startup, and it's gone pretty well, you know?
So maybe like even take like a very narrow vertical,
yeah,
where you think you could like go to a company, go to a regulator, right? Something that's a problem in one state or something like that, and really go after
restaurant
that.
Restaurant way. I mean, there's so much. Yeah. When you think about waste, it's just as overwhelming.
It's incredible.
It is nuts. So and remember, everything becomes waste,
yeah,
right? And you pick any object, there's two types of waste to think about. The waste that was created to get it there, like your pair of jeans have, you know, water waste that came off of them, all the scrap on the cut, you know, like the offcuts and so on. And then you have when it's done at its end of life.
Yeah.
And every single industry has that, and it's not really being thought about, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it's wild how, you know, we talk to big organizations like the companies that control, say, the eyeglass industry, and they haven't figured out how to recycle eyeglasses yet, right? And it's like that in everything, because it's just not thought about.
Have you ever ran into any problems with the mob?
You know, it's funny you say that. I can't operate in Italy for exactly that reason. No, it is the most crazy thing.
Wait, what?
Yeah, yeah. So Italy is sort of like two countries in this sense. There's the south and the north.
Yeah.
The north is totally coherent, everything great. But we use a lot of third-party supply chains, right?
Yeah.
Like, it's not my trucks or my, you know, this is all sort of third parties that we use. We cannot get any third parties to work with us in Italy, in the south, for exactly that reason. And so we're in all of Western Europe, but can't do Italy for you know. So
come on, Italy.
Yeah, yeah.
We're coming at you.
It's not a rumor. The mob does play a part in the garbage industry.
Okay. Definitely not a rumor.
It's definitely not a rumor. Here in New York.
It's gotten cleaned up, but.
I think so. Here it feels pretty corporate, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I feel it's pretty solid.
Yeah.
Unless you need, like, help with collections or something.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, well, we had it was famously, like, under, right, Ruckelhouse? Was that the guy from BFI, right?
Yeah.
That really went at the garbage industry.
Yeah.
His son's classmate of mine.
30 years ago or something like that, and really, like, wiped out the mob pretty much.
Yeah. It's good for it to be, like, to play in a corporate, you know, in that sense. And look at what happens. All this innovation we can't bring to a country because it really, it's used as a political wedge. Like, I remember in Naples, there was this thing where, like, some problem, you know, they were using the fact that they control waste to influence the politics there, so they would just, like, leave all the garbage in the city. You know, it's this sort of wedge, and it's antiquated. There's no need for that.
But it's no, and I don't know if this is ethical or unethical, but there's no, like, maybe sitting down with them and kind of explaining, hey, I'm not here to...
The mob?
What? You bought a building from the fucking Gambino family.
No, but that's not...
And made him understand, hey, this is just business, right? So is there a way...
Maybe you and I have to talk and we'll do a trip to the south, you know?
Sit down and make them understand, hey, I'm just here to kind of make
things
better.
It's possible. It's just
we
picking your battles,
you
know what I mean? Yeah. Look, garbage is such a monster big issue that we have lots to chew on.
I was going to call low-hanging fruit. It's like the whole freaking world.
It is.
We were talking about this. New York per day, right? 50 million pounds a day.
Yeah.
You think about it, 10 million people, 5 pounds a person.
Yeah.
That's just a lot of garbage.
It's huge. And it's getting bigger.
Yeah.
It just goes up and up, right? Isn't that wild?
Yeah.
Yeah.
What was the biggest pivot you ever had to make in this business, right? Like, I'm sure some assumption you had at the beginning.
Well, our company started not in the way I've described it to you. So, you know, the genesis moment was I was thinking about, like, purposeful business, you know, and sort of keeping my eye out. And my friends were, this was back before pot became, you know, the sort of as relaxed as it is here. We were growing some pot in our friend's basement in Montreal.
Mm-hmm.
And we couldn't get these plants to work at all. And one day my friend takes organic waste, feeds it to worms, takes the worm poop, feeds it to the plants. Eureka, the whole thing works. It was amazing.
Wow.
And so TerraCycle actually started as a worm poop company. You know, TerraCycle, like Earth Cycle, the logo actually drew as a worm originally. And we were taking organic waste, feeding it to worms, liquefying the worm poop. And then we even bottled it in old Coke and Pepsi bottles. And that's how we started. We were selling that to Walmart, you know, Home Depot, these sort of places. And we began as a consumer good company. And our thesis was we're going to make products out of garbage. And we very quickly realized, right, that if you're a consumer goods company, then the product is your hero, your business hero. So you're going to pick the very best garbage. And suddenly we were picking like this organic waste, but not that organic waste, because whatever you feed the worm, different poop comes out, you know, this sort of thing. And that was the biggest pivot for us at the very top, was to say, let's not be driven by the output, mm-hmm. and let's focus on being driven by the input and make the input the hero. And that allowed us to do what we do today, which is like everything from chewing gum recycling to diapers, cigarette butts to, you know, whatever, cosmetics.
One of the things we like to talk about, being an entrepreneur since you was 14.
Yeah.
Talk about some of your failures, or and if there was a moment that you was like, man, you know what? I'm just going to buckle down and get a regular job.
Oh, my goodness.
Have you ever had those moments?
Yeah, tons. Failure is a hard one because it's like today, you know, or this week. Like there is, we're always swimming in failure. I think the biggest lesson I've learned in the concept of failure is not that you seek it, you want to avoid it, but then how do you deal with it when it comes? And so we have this thing in our meetings. Whenever we have like a debrief on something that didn't go well, we always say, look, you know, we spent money and time on this. That's our tuition. What did we get out of it? What is the organization going to do differently? And we frame it in this idea of, you know, failure is sort of like tuition. Because what's tuition, right? You pay money, you get nothing back, right? Yeah. But you get learning back, perhaps, right? And so that's been a healthier, you know, healthy way for us to look at it, because it's constant, especially when you're innovating and you're in a world where there's no proxies to follow. You're going to be bumping against walls, you know, all the time. Outside that, to your other question, I think for me, the biggest virtue, what I look for in entrepreneurs, is the ability to grind. And that's sort of the idea that you're going to work crazy hard until you come, you know, to an immovable, like, you know, it's bankrupt or there's nothing you can do, right? And I haven't hit that low point. I came from communist Eastern Europe at the beginning, so like low is very low. You know? I mean, there's
so your family's from where?
From Hungary and Budapest.
Nice.
Yeah. But like, you know, I grew up there in the early 80s, right? So, you know, there was no money. And that's what I love coming here, because there's the floor is like not there, you know, right? Like you're going to have a roof, you're going to have food. As a result, you can take risk, right?
Yeah.
You know?
What's the single biggest thing like someone listening here can do like to take away from this in terms of like making a difference themselves? Because it is a confusing landscape.
It
do
is.
I compost? Do I save? Do I like where do you go to make the biggest impact?
And I would say the answer I'm going to give you is not just for waste. It is for everything to do with this horrible situation we're in from a planetary point of view. So pick your what you care about: species reduction, climate change, waste. It's to view, because we talked about politics a little bit, right? We get so hung up on the vote we cast, what, every 4 years. And I don't even get to vote. I'm not an American citizen. If I was, my kids don't get to vote. They're all under the age of 18, you know? In some states, if I was incarcerated, I don't get to vote. I mean, so few of us do, and so rarely, and we get so hung up on it. But I would argue that what we buy and what we don't buy is a much more powerful vote. All of us get to do it, no matter our age, you know, nationality, anything. And we do it frickin' multiple times a day, right? And the way to look at this is next time you go shop, just imagine whatever you buy, two will appear tomorrow. One to replace the thing you bought and one to signify the trend. Mm-hmm. And whatever you don't buy is also an active vote. One less will appear tomorrow because there's nothing to replace, but you're signifying the trend. And would you shop differently if that's how you viewed your active shopping? Like right. this fierce fiscal vote. And I, you know, in one of the books I wrote, we did a study on how long it would take to kill an industry if everyone stopped buying it. And we did it on chewing gum, and it was like 6 weeks.
Wow.
If the world stopped buying that object within 6 weeks, retailers would delist it, factories, you know, it would be done. Mm-hmm.
So wild.
Right? And yet, how much voting do we do unconsciously?
Right. Yeah, because these trends get started, even when they kind of lose their appeal, they don't go away. It's really interesting.
Yeah.
It just becomes part of the furniture.
Yeah. Yeah,
you know, sounds like chewing gum. We should just put out of business. Like, just make that the thing. It doesn't really serve a purpose.
That should be business untitled.
It's just sugar.
Business 2024.
Because that would be, I mean, you know, little. But
actually,
it would be,
I know
it would
Bill
be
Wrigley. He's
going to
come. He's going to come
at me. But I think you know, have that mentality, right? It's not about. Look, I think one of the issues in garbage is we like to crucify one or two things, right? Like,
it's
so everyone went on the.
Everyone loves crucifying.
Oh my God! Yeah, the Romans got it right, right? Like, there's a role, you know, and everyone, there's some entertainment in it. But like, we did it to the straw, the plastic bag.
Yeah,
they're not changing anything, right? And what we don't want to talk about is this massive sort of addiction to cheap and convenient.
Right.
And that's not something that business can talk about because it's foundationally.
You know who talked about it?
Yeah.
Ooh.
Was Greg.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
It is, yeah. So Greg Renfro, who we had on here, has a company called Beauty Counter.
Oh, yeah, I know them. Yeah, okay.
And really that is going into sustainability, yep. package, yep. what ingredients are going yep. in that are healthy yes. for you, yes. and it's really a very similar movement
yeah.
to you.
Yeah, and here's a great example where Beauty Counter is investing in running its own recycling programs, right? They're yes. saying whatever we make that we can't design into recyclability, we'll fund and right. sort of internalize that externality.
Shout out to right. Greg.
Yeah.
Yeah. Shout out to Greg.
Support Beauty Counter.
People liked our episode.
Yeah. yeah. And so I think, but that, you know, what can one do is realize your economic vote is the most powerful vote you cast.
Right. And don't always put convenience and cheap price at the top of the pyramid yeah. because effectively, de facto, almost, you're doing something worse for the environment.
That's right. Polluter.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. To your point, buy things that are going to, you know, going to cherish for a very long time. You know, make that extra investment in them. And
like this jacket.
There you go.
It's jacket out right here with the little stuff on the back.
Yeah, it's a freaking cool jacket.
10 years already.
There you go.
Definitely.
Right?
Definitely.
Gucci.
But still, not a problem, right? You know, yeah. spend a little more.
Yeah, not
right?
something
and
to get rid
enjoy
of.
It.
No, it's true. It's a good message. Spend yeah. a little more. Keep it a little longer. You're helping the environment yeah. and looking
yeah.
better.
Yeah.
Looking
all right,
fly,
Dave, you're up because we're running out of... We're running out of time. He's got a he's
we
got
all
a big,
the time in the world.
He's got a big show. He's no, got 100, you know, he's got 100 people waiting for him to tell the spit to our company.
Patience is a virtue. Okay, all right.
is it?
I'm kidding. So, at the end of our sessions, when we have all of our guests, we like to ask for their ounce of gold, which effectively is like what the ounce of gold you want to leave our listeners, our viewers with. Yeah. You've said a lot of really amazing things yeah. today, but if you have to just sum it up, what do you want to leave everybody
yeah.
with?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's what we were just talking about. I think we can really affect the world by voting consciously. And if they leave with anything, that would be the key message. And if in doubt, don't buy.
Right.
Right?
If in doubt, don't buy. And I'm going to flip this to Mike because we always give our ounce of gold to
our guests.
We give
you an ounce of gold.
Oh, my God.
Mike's the gold guy.
Today it's worth about $2,300.
That's so kind.
I think it's going to be worth a lot more.
Yeah.
It comes from our one sponsor, JM Bullion. You know, I've read today, they don't just sell gold. They sell silver, platinum, palladium. I'm actually long palladium. Chart looks great. I'm long silver. Breaks 30, it's going much higher. This is the year of precious metals, so JM Bullion is the place you got to shop. I'm a good pitch man. Here's an ounce of gold.
Oh, my man. Thank you.
Keep it in your pocket.
I will. I'm going to cherish that.
All right.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, thank you for coming
on.
Thank
you.
It's been great to meet you.
I really appreciate it.
All right, guys. Peace out. Guys, we're back.
Started off with giving Mel shit for dressing like a...
The Wolfpack is back. Just had a lot of fun with...
Tom.
Tom, Jesus. I got a name retrieval problem.
Yeah. Tom Zaki.
Tom Zaki, who was awesome, the king of trash. Yeah. Really, we learned more about recycling and waste and how to think about, you know, how we live our lives than I have in a lot of hours. Yeah. And so, I'm looking over at Mel and his gym clothes, and we might just want to recycle those things. You know, like to have a little bit more nicer dress on the podcast.
I've been working out. I think. By far, I used to be the flies guy here, then Dave took over. So I just gave up.
I just hope you posted a picture of your workout for Mike to see, because he loves that. Yeah. He loves that.
He banned me from posting.
But to be fair, Mel has lost more weight than Dave and I combined since this podcast started. So
I've
we'll
been
give
working
him,
out more than you. And,
yeah, but your well, but Dave, your whole Mike. Look has gone to hell in a handbasket.
Well, all right.
So what did you think about that episode?
I thought it was really, really dope to learn about the waste industry, recycling, how it works. I think it's like an enormous thing. We all deal with it every day, and nobody really thinks. It's like you just wrap up your trash bag, you throw it down some chute somewhere, or put it back in a can, and boom, you don't think about it. But meanwhile, that shit's piling up in landfills, incinerators, and they're shipping it to China and to, you know, formerly Staten Island. I think it's interesting to think through where that stream ends up.
I think in a weird way, like one of the most crazy things he said that made a ton of sense, it might be the biggest industry in the world because every single thing is trash.
Yeah, that's crazy.
And I didn't think of that.
99% of what you buy this year will be in a trash bin.
Right.
And every single thing you see in this room is trash.
Yeah. Now, part of that's probably food and perishables, right?
Yeah.
So some of that's natural, of course. But it's a wild statistic, and we just don't think about it at all. And I think his general premise of convenience and cheap, and that the longer you have something, the less convenient you make it, maybe even a little bit more, the more expensive it is, that, you know, it is better for the environment because you're extending that life cycle, and even though you paid more, you're not just throwing it into a landfill, which is a big deal. And that's something I think it's worth
educating. Yeah, well, it's interesting. How many things built today will actually be antiques in 100 years, right? My mother collects antiques, and I was just out of Nordys. They have some beautiful antiques from when the French came over. Yeah. Will we save and preserve the table you get at, you know, Target? No, it'll be in a landfill.
Right.
You save and preserve and cherish and look in awe and wonder at things that are wildly well built.
Yeah.
So crazy, because now that you're saying that, even expensive stuff at this point, I don't think is going to be antiques, 100 years from now. Like, think of how many things you have in your house other than art that you're like, this table or this bed or this chair is going to be an antique.
Let me say this, though. I think that that is something that will, like, you know, maybe, like, open your eyes to a little bit. Because, like, I would say, like, in my place, like, I have plenty of pieces of furniture that should be there in 100 years.
Okay.
Because some of them are made 50 years, 80 years ago.
But your place is all 1950s and 60s stuff.
Well, not all. But I'm saying there are some vintage pieces. Yeah.
But like the stuff that was made now.
Yeah, I'm saying if you bought
Something that Noé makes, a piece of furniture that Noé Dushafour makes, right? It's expensive, right? Shout out to Noé, amazing furniture designer. But his stuff is made with quality, right? And so that those pieces of furniture are going to be here for, they're going to be for decades, and they're going to be antiques. And it doesn't mean every single thing is going to be that. And fabrics, of course, are a little trickier.
Well, and again, we have 8 billion people on the planet, and only about this many can afford something that Noé builds. What was interesting is back in the old days, people had less, but they had better. And that's what he was saying.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right? And fast fashion has also created this need to just keep up all the time. Oh, I have to get this. I have to. We're purposefully at the government level a consumer society. It's what drives the economy, right? We don't have to get deep into that. But effectively, our policies are geared at consumerism. And he mentioned that right there. And what we have to do is change that where that's a part of it, but then there's a balance.
Dave Barry going green on Business Untitled right here. You saw it live.
I think it's also worthwhile pushing regulatory reform where they do start to create sliding scales and say, okay, some portion of your packaging has to be returned, or some portion of what you're, you know, the useful life of this chair or this, you know, phone or whatever, has to be extended. They can measure that just like they measure emissions.
But correct me, maybe.
But this becomes economic and racial, right? You know, if you, like, I mean, what's the number one store in most bad black communities, poor communities, is the dollar store.
Just went bankrupt.
Right, yeah.
Oh, they did?
Yeah, one of those big chains.
The dollar store. Bankrupt.
But wait, I think one of the things that he said, right, in order to, you know, make this cup a better version so you can recycle it easier, whatever the case may be, it has to cost a little more, right?
Yeah.
So he said, as a czar for trash or whatever, that's the problem you're going to run into. So that then, if they had to make this cup more money, they had to make the coffee more money. So does that drive inflation?
Yeah.
Right?
He said something a little different, though, which I thought was interesting, which was, so yes, as an economic principle, you're correct on that. But this cup actually bills itself as compostable and recyclable. But what he said was different. He said there's no market for this cup, so nobody gives a shit about recycling it. A plastic bottle actually has more value as does an aluminum can. So ironically, I would not have known that, right, because plastics are so bad for the environment. This is not a cheap cup. This is something that's purposefully compostable, but yet there's nobody that's going to actually compost these things because there's no money in composting this. Whereas plastic bottles, somebody will buy them from you and basically make something else. That's pretty interesting, actually. You know, we were talking to Mel about this, but like where there's opportunities, because whenever you've got a big industry like this that's got, you know, very few real big players, big corporate players, there's probably a million places.
Yeah, not enough people looking at the trash and recycling industry.
Right.
My ounce of goal is start picking up trash on the street and staring at it for 10 to 20 seconds and figuring it out how you can make some money off it.
You know what else I'm going to even
say? The trash whisper.
What I'm going to say is he talked about construction waste. We hit on that for a second. That's one of the main things that drives...
Did that touch your soul, Dave?
No, what it does? No, you
Dave's
know
got very clean, very clean.
No, no, he definitely
business,
does.
Business sites.
No, it's really the main thing that drives modular and prefab housing. So when you look at those movements, the main driver behind that is less waste. Because if you're making these things in a factory, you're not out in the field cutting sheetrock, cutting pipes, throwing it all in dumpsters. You're basically in a much more controlled environment where you can control your inputs much better, and therefore the waste is dramatically less when they're doing these like prefab buildings.
So a guy like our friend, and you guys are part of that company, Habitats, who creates their hotels in Mexico in one place and then takes them to wherever in the world it needs to go. Does that count as one of those things?
Yeah, it does.
Okay. You know, I mean, that's on a smaller scale because they're just building themselves. Yeah. But yeah, it does.
There are giant companies that do this now.
Oh, really?
Or that are trying to do it. Yeah, they are doing it. And it's just, it's challenging, right? Every jurisdiction has different laws, different structures, different site. There's challenges to it. But one of the main drivers behind it is trying to reduce waste in the construction industry because it's a big deal.
Guys, we'll be back next week with another episode of Business Untitled.
Peace out.
Peace out.
And Martha Stewart still won't be here.